Thanks, Becca. Thank you all for coming. So good afternoon. My name is Aliza Wasserman, and I work in the Offices of Policy and Planning and Intergovernmental Relations and Public Health Advocacy at the Boston Public Health Commission, which is the City Department of Health for Boston. So I'm going to talk a little bit about a big city urban perspective of a local health department and some of the kinds of food policy that you can really tackle at the local level based on some examples from Boston. And just to say, some of the work I'm talking about, most of it's in partnership with folks in the mayor's office, other city agencies, and community agencies like the Boston Collaborative for Food and Fitness. I have no disclosures to make. So just looking at this map, I just wanted to situate us where we are. We're around here right now, South Boston, and you can see this is a map of obesity rates in Boston. You can see the dark blue of North Dorchester and Mattapan have significantly higher rates of obesity than the rest of Boston, and then South Dorchester, my mouse has gone away, South Dorchester, Roxbury, Hyde Park, and East Boston are also have elevated rates of obesity. And we focus a lot of our work on these neighborhoods because this is a pattern we see across most of the health outcomes we look at. They have significantly, there's folks who live in these neighborhoods are significantly worse off, and they're primarily communities of color. And what we know is that they experience completely different environments based on the neighborhoods that folks live in. And this is really the motivation, the motivation for our work is to make an impact on this map. And this is something that underlies all of our local food policy work. And similarly, you see here that the rates of diabetes are almost double for black residents in Boston what they are for white residents in Boston. And despite what many of us know about the fact that the biggest impact on these health outcomes come from the environments that we live in, and what we saw on the map on the previous slide and these diabetes rates. Unfortunately, most of what we still hear about how to impact obesity and chronic disease focuses on individual behavior and household behavior. And this is something I just want to point out that, you know, the policy work is a really important way to actually get at these outcomes from a different perspective and not to actually focus on what we know to be evidence-based and not only focus on individual behaviors. And I just want to say I put this chart and the last map up not to shame people who are experiencing these poor health outcomes, which, however, is the response that we often get when we show these kinds of data to community residents. It often does. It is not a pleasant experience for folks. It's often, you know, folks feel like they're being targeted, like, why are you telling us, you know, all these terrible things about us? But you know, I'm showing it to you because it's to illustrate that we have a major problem in our city when we see diabetes rates that are almost double for black residents in Boston what they are for white residents. And so because of this problem, we have overarching goals in the city. So this is a busy slide. I'm just going to direct your attention to the green on your right side. And these overarching goals are to actually look at three of the most persistent racial disparity diseases with racial disparities and ethnic disparities in the city of Boston that are persistent. So we see a persistent gap that although the rates have gone down for these significantly, the gap has not narrowed. And so we've set five-year goals to actually reduce the gap in these conditions of obesity, chlamydia, and low birth weight. And so the green is focusing on trying to narrow the gap in obesity rates between black and Latino adults and school-aged children and white adults and school-aged children in 5 years. And this is really a pretty new effort to actually not just measure the services that are delivered or, you know, the policies that are changed, but actually to say these outcomes have to change. This gap has to be narrowed in a specific amount of time. So food policy is one of the tools we can to get at these issues at the local level, but it's really also important to look at other areas of policy that intersect, and that's something you can really do at the local level. Really need to look at the legacy of residential segregation and other structural differences in the context in which people live, which are due to the racism that's baked into our society and the policies that we experience at the local and state and federal level. So I'm basically going to be going through some examples of how strategies to work on local food policy or food policy at the local level. And so the areas, the kind of buckets are expanding on a federal program, either with added local funding or using an option of a federal policy, using federal funds to support local food systems, using whatever local authority you have, which is very variable based even within the state of Massachusetts. It's variable, but across the country, local boards of health, zoning authority, et cetera, there's a lot of options here. And then advocating for change on state and federal law and implementing legislation. And then finally, what I'm calling using the bully pulpit, but, you know, kind of array of other ways that you can make a dent on policy based on looking at institutional policies at a local level. And so just wanted to point out a lot of the work I'm talking about is in partnership with the Mayor's Office of Food Initiatives in Boston, which was started in 2010. And, you know, there are some programs here I'll talk about, and there are some other programs here that I'm not going to touch on specifically, but it really shows there are a lot of other goals besides what I talked about, reducing health inequities, economic development goals, supporting local economy, environmental sustainability, and trying to prevent climate change. So for the first example I'm going to give around expanding on a federal program, this is looking at the SNAP program, Boston Bounty Bucks, which was started in 2008 by the Food Project, which is a youth development and farming organization. We have some folks in the house from there, you can see, and the mayor's office. And it's a double voucher, double coupon voucher program, so that folks who are SNAP participants, for every dollar they spend at farmers markets in the city of Boston, up to $10, they get a dollar-for-dollar match. And it's really a way to harness what we know for SNAP is that every dollar that's spent is actually $1.75 that goes into the economy, and this is a way to actually keep that $1.75 in the local or the state economy. And it's, you know, since this started in 2008, you can see a huge growth in the number of farmers markets that are participating, as well as the sales, and this is, you know, really increasing sales of local farmers in Massachusetts, actually beyond just Massachusetts, regional farmers that are able to benefit from SNAP participants. And it's expanded across the nation, this type of program. A lot of you are probably involved with those kinds of programs. And something, you know, in terms of connecting with the federal, which I'll talk a little bit more about, right now there's been efforts to try to get more federal funding for these kinds of double coupon voucher programs to be able to really build up what we can do with the SNAP program. Another example around federal funds, so this is also going to connect with the Food Project. Basically, there in 2004, there was a greenhouse that was built in Dudley in the Roxbury neighborhood in Boston. This was on the site that was formerly a mechanics shop, and it was there were a lot of environmental hazards on the site. It had been remediated by the Mass Highway Department. Things like, you know, very elevated lead levels, a lot of remediation that happened. But unfortunately, the greenhouse wasn't being used because the initial investment wasn't enough to actually make it usable. And so what the Public Health Commission was able to do with federal funding through the stimulus program, through the CDC's Communities Putting Prevention to Work, was to actually support what the community already wanted to happen, the Food Project, along with the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative, which owned the greenhouse, was to actually renovate it and make it usable, which is what happened. And there's now a 10,000 square foot greenhouse in Dudley Square that produces, last year produced $50,000 in income, sales to It sustains itself economically at this point by selling tomatoes and greens to restaurants as well as seedlings. It's a space for a lot of education happens where neighborhood schools can come in and garden. And then I think the most exciting part is it functions as a community food hub. A lot of community folks come in and out to learn about gardening, and it's a year-round space, and it's actually become way beyond just growing food in terms of, you know, learning more about food systems, adults, youth from the neighborhood. And there's a neighborhood advisory council that determines the uses of the plots in the greenhouse and what's going to happen with it. So it's a pretty innovative way that federal public health funding was actually used to create a new food system opportunity. So moving from federal programs to more the local authority, I'm going to talk a little bit about Urban Ag Initiative in the city of Boston. Basically, in the past, because of our very old zoning code in Boston and some changes that had happened over time, urban agriculture is actually, because it was not explicitly mentioned, it's been essentially prohibited in the city, although there are obviously some programs like the Food Project and other nonprofit organizations that have small farms, there are community gardens, but there's been a really strong interest from the urban agriculture community in expanding the opportunities for both residential and commercial urban agriculture. So there's a process launched really because of the mayor's interest in and working with the community, the urban agriculture community, in changing this. There was a process of updating the zoning code, and it's a really long document, what was created, which is Article 89 of the Boston Zoning Code. It was a long process beginning in 2012 where there are 22 folks of this urban agriculture working group that were meeting at least monthly, including local farmers, community residents, others who are sort of experts on soil health, public health, bees, etc., beekeeping, etc. And they came up with a draft, and then there was a series of neighborhood meetings in the past 6 months to really vet this with different neighborhoods because, you know, not everyone understands what this really means and how this is going to change the landscape and their environment in their neighborhood and having urban agriculture in residential neighborhoods. And so it's still in process. It's supposed to be going before the Boston Redevelopment Authority Board and the Zoning Commission in the next month or so, but hopefully will be a completely changed opportunity for urban agriculture and subsequently keeping of chickens and bees in neighborhoods that choose to allow the keeping of hens and bees. And just to say, a lot of this process happened because it's been a challenging process. While there's a lot of support in the urban agriculture community, as I said, it's been received differently by different communities in the city. I would say there's been some misinformation that's been just out there. The zoning code is really old, and frankly, you know, we're just a really dense city, and so these are difficult issues to tackle, but hopefully now that we have there, you know, other dense parts of the country will be able to learn and share best practices about how to do this. So moving to more of the advocacy end of things, the next two slides are going to be focusing on advocacy and implementation of state and federal school nutrition laws, both of which happened in 2010. The state law was mostly focused on competitive foods. It had some other pieces to it, but the school nutrition piece of it was primarily focused on competitive foods. And actually, Boston had already implemented pretty much the level of standards around competitive foods, which just to say, competitive foods is food that's sold in schools outside of school meal programs. And so this is sort of putting nutrition standards on those foods. And although Boston had implemented pretty strict standards on competitive foods and beverages prior, it was something we actually really did advocate for on the local, from the local level to the state, because it really behooved us to have additional, to have, you know, all the other cities and towns in the Commonwealth have kind of similar standards, both because it would actually improve the options of what kind of products could be sold, so the market, you know, there'd be more leverage in the market for healthy products that kids actually might want to drink or eat, and also because it would create more, it would and did create more accountability for all the schools in the district that this is actually a state law. It's not just a district or city, a district or city policy. In the school lunch realm, for child nutrition reauthorization, I think this was something that was really welcome in the city because we were, for a while, in the process of trying to improve the nutritional quality of school lunch and school breakfast. And this, you know, this similarly created the sort of federal context for that to happen. I would say it's, we're still in the process of figuring out how to both implement the new school meal patterns and deal with the costs associated with that. I think that's an issue that a lot of districts have been facing, so maybe that'll be a discussion point. And then the other piece I'll say on that is that just this past school year, Boston was able to take advantage of a local, a pilot that 10 states had as part of child nutrition reauthorization to expand what's called community eligibility. So for districts where over 40% of students are eligible for free school lunch, to actually eliminate the paperwork and the segmenting kids and actually just make all students eligible for free lunch. And this has been huge. It's just been implemented this school year in Boston, but it's expected to increase revenue to the district by $2.7 million, and that's obviously on top of it's reducing costs for a lot of families in the district and increasing participation in the school meal programs, which really also, you know, helps the district. There's increased participation. It leverages, increases the leverage for things like farm to school of what we can actually purchase as an entity. On the advocacy front, looking more at the national level, we've been fortunate to be at the, some might say, the cutting edge. The U.S. Conference of Mayors has a food policy task force that was started by Mayor Menino of Boston and Mayor Rawlings Blake of Baltimore in 2012, and that's really been an opportunity for cities across the country, many of which now have offices of food policy or food directors, to really share best practices, to be able to advocate together. So they've been actively working to advocate on the farm bill, to protect SNAP, to, you know, look at things like double coupon vouchers for farmers markets, to work with the USDA around what is this set of urban issues, through things like U.S. Conference of Mayors resolutions. And one of the directions they are looking at moving forward is to really engage more with the grocery industry around what food access looks like in cities. And then finally, the last example is what I'm calling a bully pulpit. And, you know, this example actually includes more than just, it does include an executive order. This is something folks might have heard more about, where the mayor actually banned sales of sugary drinks on city property in 2011. I put this under bully pulpit because it was really part of a strategy to change institutional policies around beverage environments across institutions in the city. And so it was using city buildings as an example, both for the public, for folks who work in those buildings, as well as to encourage other work sites to do similar things. And the other piece of that was the Hospital Learning Collaborative. Healthcare is a huge part of the a huge economic driver in Boston, and so this was an opportunity for hospitals to really actually create healthy environments. There were 10 hospitals involved, and a lot of changes really did happen. One hospital, as a result of this, one hospital actually banned the sale of sugary drinks, and then a number of them made changes to pricing strategies for sugary drinks relative to healthier beverages and water. They also used similar point of sale signage to inform people that matched what the city used for the city property, and there are a number of other changes that happened. And then these are just additional opportunities that are kind of happening currently, moving forward at the local food policy level. So, thank you.